So glad you guys could be here today. For our students that know me, I'm going to introduce myself to the rest that don't. I'm the Worldview Director for Prestonwood Christian Academy. My name is Dan Panetti, and I'm so pleased to welcome not only our students who are used to this, but students from other schools and obviously some adults from around the area. I want to thank especially Prestonwood Baptist Church for hosting us and letting us come into the sanctuary today, the worship center. What a great facility we have to host a debate, and as well as our school, Prestonwood Christian Academy, for putting this together, and all those who worked behind the scenes to make this a reality. There's a lot of work that went on. I would know because all the people who were working kept telling me what to do, and when I didn't do it, they did it for me, so I appreciate that tremendously. But what a great day we have for you. We also have Seven Star Academy is actually a great sponsor for us because they are webcasting this debate. Which is why you'll see so many different cameras around and so many different angles. So there are schools all over the country that instead of sitting here with us, are sitting in cafeterias and classrooms and watching the debate, and they'll be discussing the debate just like you will afterwards. So from Mexico City to North Carolina to Kansas, schools from all across the country will be watching live just like you're watching, and then the webcast is actually going to be archived and people will be watching it later. So we thank Seven Star Academy for that. Just a couple quick announcements before we dive into what we're doing here. First of all, if you have a cell phone on, it would be a great time to turn it off, or at least turn it down. That would be fabulous. Please don't get up and walk around or fidget. Be nice just to sit through here. We're not going to do a lot of applause during the debate until after. So when somebody says something you think is great, wait for the person on the opposing side to say something that tears it down, and vice versa. So if you see something or hear something that you don't like, don't worry, the other person will respond to that. This isn't your debate. This is an opportunity for you to listen and to think within your own mind. What would I say and how would I respond to that? But we have two excellent people to take care of that for us today. So we'll be here. The debate will be back and forth. There will be a time for question and answers. You are given a card. If you don't have your card yet, those cards will be passed out to you. And if you have a question after the opening statements, you'll be able to write down the questions, and then when they go to their back and forth, we'll be collecting the cards after their opening statements are done. Those cards will be reviewed, make sure we get a balanced representation from the audience, some questions for both individuals, and then when we do the question and answers from the audience, I'll be reading the questions myself from the podium here or from up front here. So if you have a question during the debate that you want one of these gentlemen to answer, make sure you write it down on that card and turn it in when it's appropriate time. Let me go ahead and open us up in a quick word of prayer here, and then we'll introduce the two gentlemen that we brought in for the debate. Lord, we thank you so much for today. We thank you for the beautiful weather that we're having. We thank you for each of the individuals that are here. Father, thank you especially for Dan Barker and Dinesh D'Souza for coming and spending their time. Father, for presenting evidence, Father, that we can consider, that we can reason about, Father, that we can take home and think about, and Father, that we can draw close to you in our pursuit of you. Father, our desire is that we would desire to know the truth. And Father, your word has said that the truth will set us free. So Lord, I pray that you'd open up our minds and our hearts, Father, to the truth that you have presented for us. And Father, I just pray that you'd give us a wonderful time today, Father, as we argue and reason together. In Jesus' name, amen. Now I got that from Isaiah chapter 1 where the Lord says, come, let us argue, come, let us reason together. Maybe a little bit unusual for you to be at a debate in a church where we're asking the question, does God exist? Is there a reason to believe in God? I think it's probably somewhat humorous for God to sit and listen, for us to argue as his creation whether he exists or not. But there's evidence on both sides. And to present the evidence, we brought two gentlemen that have debated before. So they know each other well and they know each other's arguments well. But this is new for us and something exciting for us to be a part of. Dan Barker, who I'll introduce first, has an interesting background because he's a former minister. At the age of 15, Dan Barker became a teenage evangelist. He received his degree in religion from Azusa Pacific University when he was ordained a minister by Standard Community Church, California, in 1975. He served as an associate pastor at a Friends, a Quakers church, an Assembly of God, and an independent charismatic church. He was a Protestant ministry in Mexico for a total of 2 years. He maintained a touring musical ministry for 17 years and has accomplished a pianist, record producer, and arranger and songwriter. For many years, he wrote and produced the annual mini musical for Gospel Light Publications' Vacation Bible School curriculum, which I'm sure some of us have gone through. Following 5 years of reading, Dan gradually outgrew his religious beliefs. He says, if I'd limited myself to Christian authors only, I'd still be a Christian today. But he lost his faith in faith. He publicly announced his atheism in January 1984. And actually, shortly thereafter, was on the Oprah Winfrey Show to announce that to the rest of the world. So it was quite a coming out there. He is now the PR director, or was the PR director, for the Freedom From Religious Foundation from 87 to 2004. And he was elected co-president of the founder with Annie Laurie Gaylor in 2004. He's a contributing editor of Free Thought Today and is involved with the foundation's state church lawsuits. This is Dan Barker. Dinesh D'Souza is a man, a young man at that time, that I heard speak back in the early 90s, shortly after he'd spent some time in the Reagan White House. He's considered one of the top young policymakers in the country. New York Times Magazine has named him one of America's most influential conservative thinkers. He's a former policy analyst in the Reagan White House, and he served in the American Enterprise Institute, and he served was a writer at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth College in 1983. He's written a number of books and won a number of major awards. Some of the most popular books, and the reason that we brought him here today, What's So Popular or What's So Great About Christianity, and a book that he has just released in November and will be available for a book signing afterward, is Life After Death, The Evidence. He writes a daily blog on AOL, a weekly column for townhall.com, speaks at top universities, business groups, civics, and churches across the country. Please welcome Dinesh D'Souza. We are going to start with their opening arguments. And remember, after their opening arguments are done, if you'd like to have a question, please write it down, and we'll pick those up, pass them down to the end of your rows, so we don't have to grab them from each one of you, but pass them down, and we'll pick them up at the end of the rows and take them back. So, Dan Barker, I believe you're starting.
Thank you, Dan. No, I don't have horns. Atheists are people too. Millions of good Americans don't believe in a God, and we love our families. We vote in elections, contribute to charity, serve in the military. We're your neighbors. We're just like you, and we're a growing number of people who prefer reason and kindness over superstition and faith. And I want to thank Prestonwood Christian Academy for all of your hospitality. You've been very gracious, very good people, and it's been a real pleasure to meet you. As Dan told you, I was a born-again Christian. I was called to the ministry. I preached the gospel for 19 years, mission work, evangelism, Christian songwriter. I'm still getting royalties from those Christian musicals, which is kind of fun. And I was a true believer. I really did believe it. I prayed. I talked with Jesus. I got goosebumps. I felt this father figure. I was born again. I read the Bible. I believed it was an inerrant word of God. All of that was so wonderful and moving to me. And if I was not a true Christian, nobody is. I truly believed it and lived it. And doesn't the Bible say, "You shall know them by their fruits"? You don't judge yourself whether somebody's a true Christian or not. You know them by their fruits. But I changed my mind, and I'm not going to tell you that whole story, but I eventually learned after 4 or 5 years of a gradual migration that there is no evidence for a God. Zero. In fact, Dinesh agrees with me. During our debate in Harvard last year, Dinesh said, "I am an agnostic too." We don't know if there's a God, Dinesh said. I admit it. Dinesh is kind of like another Catholic, Blaise Pascal, the mathematician philosopher, who said the same thing. He was an agnostic. He said, "We can't know, we don't know, but you're better off believing." And so Dinesh says he thinks, because most people on the planet are believers, he says, what's wrong with belief? Pascal and Dinesh are what you might call theistic agnostics, and that's a very honest position, by the way. I admire that and respect that, because he's not pretending more than he can support. I am what you would call an atheistic agnostic. Atheism is simply the absence of theism. I'm also an atheist because there's no good argument for a God. Bertrand Russell looked at all the arguments, especially the ontological argument and the teleological and the cosmological and all that, and we do debates about these things all the time. And Bertrand Russell basically concluded, you know, these are all boiled down to bad grammar is all it is. None of those arguments work, and we'll talk about a little of them later. I'm also an atheist because there's no coherent definition of a God. How can you debate if something exists if you can't even define what it is? There is no agreement among believers as to the nature of this God or the moral principles of this God. Every one of them can open the Bible and show you, oh, here's what we believe. This church here believes that Jesus was the eternal Son of God. And that, did you know that John Calvin, a Protestant reformer, had one of his close friends, Michael Servetus, burned at the stake, a co-reformer, because Michael Servetus said, no, Jesus is not the eternal Son of God. Jesus is the Son of the eternal God. He was killed for that. Protestants killing Protestants for heresy and for blasphemy. Catholics killing other Catholics. Catholics killing Protestants because they didn't have the truth. I'm also an atheist because there are no good replies to the arguments against a God. For example, the problem of evil. All you have to do is walk into any children's hospital and you know there is no God. Those parents are desperately praying for their children. They don't fare any better than blind chance. Many of them pray and those kids die horrible deaths. And the ones that do survive, it's no difference from those who weren't prayed for. Prayer is a failure. Prayer might make you feel better. Prayer might help lower your blood pressure. But as organic healing, prayer is a failure. And finally, I'm an atheist because there's no need for a God. Millions of good people live moral lives, happy, loving, meaningful, purposeful lives without the belief in a God. And some of them are here in this audience. I know some of you came to sit in on this debate. Christianity has got it all wrong. Christianity is not true. The truth claims of Christianity are simply not supportable. I used to preach that the Bible was reliable. The Bible was our guidebook. The Bible was our absolute truth. But when you look at the Bible carefully, as an outsider would, and you look at the internal contradictions, the historical anachronisms, you look at the scientific inaccuracies in there, you look at some of the horrible examples of morality that are in that book, we have to conclude the Bible is not a basis for truth. There's a better way. Christianity has it all upside down. We are not treasure in earthen vessels. The earthen vessel is the treasure. We are biological organisms. We are animals. We evolved as animals. Now, Dinesh has written a really good book. What's so great about Christianity? For me, it's a mixed bag, obviously, and there are some howling mistakes in here, but there are some beautiful, eloquent passages that he has written that I really admire. For example, his passionate defense of the truth of evolution, I think is incredible. In a few pages, he succinctly tells us why evolution is true. He quotes the Pope admiringly, who says that evolution is more than a hypothesis. He says, evolution remains the best and most persuasive account of our origins. It is impossible to deny the theory's explanatory power. And you're also very charitable, I notice, in there, because while you disagree with Richard Dawkins on the God question, you seem to admire Dawkins when he stays within biology, when he talks about the selfish gene and evolution and how we came. And you do point out correctly that many or most Christians find no conflict at all between evolution and their faith. However, in making the case that there had to be a first cause, Dinesh, in his book, refers to the singularity, that there was a beginning of the universe, that one of these cosmological arguments. And he quotes Stephen Hawking in here saying, there was, in fact, a singularity. There must have been a Big Bang singularity. Dinesh quotes Stephen Hawking in A Brief History of Time. There must have been a Big Bang singularity. And based on that claim, the scientists made that there was a singularity, which means it was infinitely small space with an infinite amount of density. Dinesh goes on to say, well, then there was a beginning of time and a beginning of the universe, and therefore there must be something transcendent to the universe. You've all heard this argument before. But the point I want to make is that Dinesh completely misquotes Stephen Hawking. If you would just read the passage that you were quoting from, you said that Hawking said there must have been a Big Bang singularity. Here is what the paragraph actually says in that book. Hawking says, the final result was a joint paper by Penrose and myself in 1970, which at last proved that there must have been a Big Bang singularity, as you quote, provided only that general relativity is correct and the universe contains as much matter as we observe. He goes on to say, Hawking says, in the end, our work became generally accepted. In fact, I used to believe that too. I used to say that same thing. And nowadays, nearly everyone assumes that the universe started with a Big Bang singularity. It's perhaps ironic that having changed my mind, I am now trying to convince other physicists that there was, in fact, no singularity at the beginning of the universe, as we shall see later. It can disappear once quantum effects are taken into account. So the very paragraph that you're quoting to support your position actually says the exact opposite of what you intend your readers to believe. I think Dinesh is a good guy. I like him, and I don't think he's deliberately lying. I think he was just sloppy. He didn't read it right in the context, and that happens to all of us. It's happened to me. We're all human beings. Later in Dinesh's, in fact, I'm indebted to Victor Stenger for bringing this out. He's researched a lot of the attacks on the new atheism. Victor Stenger's book is called The New Atheism, and he also exposes other howling mistakes that people like D'Souza have made in their attempts to try to substantiate God and Christianity. But also, Dinesh talks about causality and says, even David Hume knew there was no such thing as an uncaused cause. Well, of course David Hume thought that, because he didn't know about quantum mechanics. Dinesh seems to be working back in the 1970s with his idea of what cosmology is like I used to think, but we have learned a lot since then. And now when you take quantum mechanics into effect, we realize that there, in fact, are uncaused causes in the universe. I won't dwell too much more on the book. I admire a lot of this, but he also misquotes Scripture. Galatians 3:28, he quotes it totally out of context, claiming that Christianity brings equality. There's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free. And yet that applies only to baptized Christians. And Paul in Galatians goes on to say specifically that Arabs are excluded from this equality. Arabs are the son of the bondwoman and must be cast out. So the arguments for the existence of a God are spurious. You scratch beneath the surface. And besides, if there really were evidence for a God, think about this. If there really were evidence for a God, by now someone should have won the Nobel Prize for pointing that out. Any scientist in the world would love to jump at that. And Dinesh isn't fighting that fight. In fact, Dinesh doesn't really debate the traditional apologetic evidentiary types of arguments. Dinesh basically is taking a different approach, that the usefulness of Christianity and the commonality of belief among so many people believe there must be something to it, right? But of course, belief is going down in the world. In the United States, non-belief is the fastest growing belief in the country right now. Did you know that? College students to 20-something age are the least religious they've ever been. 25 to 30% of that generation are finally getting rid of the shackles of religion. I think people like Dinesh, as sincere as he is and as smart as he is and as kind as he is, I think their approach is not so much to argue for the faith, but to attack the other side. Much of Dinesh's writings is really just an attack on atheists. He claims, for example, and I agree, Joseph Stalin was a horrible atheist, a horrible embarrassment. But Adolf Hitler was a horrible Christian. When I was a Christian, I never would have thought Hitler represented Christianity. I would have said, well, Hitler was not a true Christian, therefore we can't count him. And yet, he was a member of the church. He credited Jesus as his inspiration for exterminating the Jews. He had God is with us, Gott mit uns, on the Nazis' belt buckles. Hitler was not an atheist or a Hindu or you know, whatever. He was a member of the church, a horrible example of what a Christian should be. But then If you can excuse Hitler by saying he wasn't a true Christian, well, why couldn't I excuse Stalin by saying, well, Stalin wasn't a true atheist, right? What a silly argument. Obviously, Stalin was not a true humanist. Atheism is simply the lack of a belief in God. Atheism is not a moral philosophy. Atheism doesn't pretend to make you a better person. Christianity does, and yet when you compare the lives of Christians and atheists, you don't see any difference. Even George Barna, in his writings, admits, we Christians are failing. There is no difference. Christian young people, even the young people in this church, are having sex just as often as non-Christian young people. That they're the same species, the same people, even in spite of this abstinence thing, in spite of my and your parental admonition to these young people out here about waiting for marriage, it's about the same rate. Non-Christians, atheists, and Christians and born-again, if you take it, you look at it, the divorce rate among Christians, born-again Christians, is actually higher than the divorce rate among non-Christians. And George Barna, who's an evangelical Christian, goes to great lengths to prove these things, chastising the church for failing. The difference between the Christian young people who are having unwise premarital sex, and I think it is unwise, is that they are not using protection. Christian young people are at a much higher risk of disease and of pregnancy than those who are at least informed enough to know if I'm going to do this, I should at least have some kind of protection. There's one of the dangers of Christianity, denying what is obvious about our natural human nature. So Christianity is not true, it is not reasonable, it is not a good moral guide. I think, however, most Christians are good people. I have a lot of good Christian friends. They are good people, but that's not because of Christianity. The goodness that Christianity and Islam and Judaism and all these other religions have in common is because it's a humanistic thing. We all know what kindness and goodness is. We all want peace. We all want less violence. We all want a world with more understanding, more acceptance, and more love. We all want those same things. Those are not Christian values. Those are human values. I think I can applaud most of you Christians for living truly good lives because you know what it means to be a true humanist, and you're smarter than Jesus was. You are kinder than the God of the Bible. You are good in spite of Christianity, and I applaud you for that. And I consider that we are all members of the same human species.
I want to say what a great privilege it is to be here. I have crossed swords with Dan a couple of times. As you probably figured by now, he was a devout Christian, then he had a bad accident, fell on his head, and that's why he's been saying the stuff he's been saying ever since. Boy, Dan, I'm tempted to jump right into my rebuttal. Dan has raised so many points, I feel a bit like the mosquito at the nudist colony. I'm just not sure where to begin. But I think I'm going to begin. I want to begin by changing my approach here. I was going to talk broadly about Christianity and its role in the world. But I want to address head up front this question of whether or not there is evidence for God, evidence for Christianity. I've done a few debates, and in talking about God, sometimes what I say is that we can't know, and by here I mean on the basis of reason, we can't know if there is an afterlife. We can't know if there is a God. Why? Because we don't see him. It's not as if God has stamped his name on the moon. It's not as if we have been able to go to the other side of the curtain or interview dead guys to find out if there's life after death. We can't know in that sense. In that way, that's why we are called believers. There's a big difference between belief and knowledge. I would say that I believe in Papua New Guinea. I believe it's over there. I haven't been, but I believe in it. I wouldn't say I believe in my brother, because I know the guy. So there's a key distinction here between belief and knowledge, and I think we should be honest about that. On the other hand, I do think that there is powerful evidence, both for God and specifically for Christianity, and I'm going to focus my opening remarks on some of that evidence. First of all, here we are flung into the world, and we have to ask some questions about it. The first one is, how did we get a world? How did we get a universe? Now, for a couple of centuries, there was a kind of scientific answer to this question that seemed to support atheism. Namely, the universe has always existed. There's always been a universe. There's no reason to ask how we got it. It's always been there. The universe is forever. Now, one of the most important scientific discoveries of the 20th century is that this notion that the universe is forever is factually false. The universe is not forever. The universe had a beginning. In physics, it's called the Big Bang. In a sense, first there was nothing, and then there was a universe. Now, if you think about this for a moment, this idea that first there was nothing and then there was a universe actually was stated before the scientists figured it out. The writers of the first book of Genesis, a bunch of Hebrews or Jews, they said first there was nothing and then there was a universe. And interestingly, these ancient Hebrews, if you ask them, well, did you do any scientific experiments to figure it out? They would say, no, we didn't do any experiments. God told us. This is how it happened. And you might say, well, yeah, but this is common to every other religion. They say the same thing. But actually, no. In most other religions in the world, the idea is that a god, or sometimes gods, fashioned the universe from some other existing stuff. Gods took some clay, or they took some pre-existing material, and like carpenters or architects, they built the universe. But the Jews were the first to say, in effect, no, the universe was made, as the Greeks said, ex nihilo, out of nothing. And what I'm saying is that today, modern science has discovered that that is basically true. Now, not only did the universe have a beginning, but very interestingly, space and time also had a beginning. By the way, this is important because space and time, scientists used to believe that space and time are eternal, which actually makes a certain kind of common sense. If somebody says, what happened a million years ago? Well, there was 1,001,000 years ago before that. Any time that you can posit in the past, there was the day before, the year before that. So time appears to stretch indefinitely, and space also. If Dan Panetti were to tell you, well, you know, space, it kind of comes to an end at that wall, you would say, well, but what's on the other side of that wall? More space. So space and time appear infinite. But modern science tells us no. Space and time are properties of our universe, which means that beyond our universe, no space, no time. Christianity has for many centuries maintained this idea of eternity, which is the idea of a God who exists outside of space and time. And what I'm saying is that this idea, which seemed a little bit crazy, very difficult to explain 100 years ago, now makes complete sense within modern physics. So my question to Dan Barker is this. If God didn't make the universe, who did? How did we get a universe? First there was nothing, and then there's a universe. If God doesn't explain it, why don't you do? Why don't you give us the explanation? Dan Barker cited Stephen Hawking in a rather convoluted quote that, far from undermining what I said, actually supported it. Stephen Hawking is the guy who did equations to show that, yes, the universe has a beginning. And then Stephen Hawking said, when I proved this, I became alarmed because I realized the theistic implications. In other words, nothing can come out of nothing. If the universe, there was nothing and then there was a universe, this seems to give support to the idea of a creator. So Hawking said, I'm very uncomfortable with that. I have to try now to figure out a way how this could have happened without God. And Hawking advances a theory which revolves on quantum fluctuations. Now, here's what Hawking says. He says, maybe the universe came into existence in what he calls, quote, imaginary time. Is there such a thing as imaginary time? No. Where does the idea of imaginary time exist? pretty much in Stephen Hawking's imagination. If you ask Stephen Hawking, do you have one shred of empirical evidence for your theory? He says, I have to confess, I don't. I've essentially made it up to get around the idea of God. And Hawking admits, my fellow physicists don't agree with me. They kind of laugh this as ridiculous. But Hawking says, but that's my theory. All right. But we are relying here on Stephen Hawking's reputation as a scientist, not on his atheist imagination. Now, I've spoken for a moment about the universe having a beginning. I think that points to a creator. Let me give you a second argument, which is sometimes called the fine-tuning argument. And the idea here is that our universe operates according to some very specific numerical values. If I take this pen and drop it, it will accelerate to the ground at a known speed. That's the speed of gravity. That's the force of gravity pulling the pen, if you will, to the ground. If a light beam flashes by us, it travels at a known speed. In science, that's called c, 186,000 miles a second in a vacuum. So the universe has multiple values, the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, something called the weak force. And one physicist, Lee Smolin, who teaches at Princeton, he says it's sort of like this. It's like God is sitting at a big desk, and he's got 100 different dials, each representing one numerical constant, very precisely set to a fixed number. And then Lee Smolin says, but what if we scientists sneak into the room, and when God isn't looking, we fool with the dials? We change it. What if light were not to travel at 186,000 miles a second? What if it was 200,000 miles a second? What if the values of the universe were a little different? And then, this question, by the way, is studied by Stephen Hawking, and he describes it in his book, A Brief History of Time. He says, basically, that if you come in and you touch one of the dials, in this case, the rate of expansion of the universe, and you move it, he says, not 10%, not 1%, but one part in 100,000th millionth million, you would have no universe, you would have no life. In other words, the numerical values of our world have to be precisely what they are, because if they didn't, we wouldn't be here. The constants of the universe have to be fine-tuned in such a way that if they were any different, essentially there would be no existence, we certainly wouldn't be having this conversation. The universe is, you may say, a conspiracy to produce, well, us. Now, this argument, which is the fine-tuned universe, has put modern atheism completely on the defensive. Again, I would invite Dan Barker, if we don't have a fine-tuner that tuned the universe in this way, how did it get to be this way, I ask. Now, remember, this is an argument completely immune from Darwinian attack. We're not talking about whether the dog and the wolf had a common ancestor. We're not talking about whether life form A became life form B. That's irrelevant. We're talking about why the entire universe is the way it is. Not just our planet Earth, but the entire universe. I would say that the fine-tuning of the universe is a strong indication that there is a creator or a designer, and moreover, one that cares about life. Why? Because the universe is fine-tuned for life. If it were tuned differently, there would be no life in it. I've spoken a little bit about God, and I want to speak a little more specifically about Christianity. And I want, in some senses, to zoom right in and talk about the central event that defines Christianity, namely the resurrection. I've just written a book on life after death. Christianity is unique in all the religions of the world in saying that life after death is not just coming sometime, it's already happened. There's a guy, Christ, he died, he came back. And I want to look for a moment at the resurrection as a historical event. I want to ask, is there actually some evidence for the resurrection? And I want to begin with a few facts that historians agree on. Mainstream historians generally concede that these facts occurred. Now we're going to try to make sense of these facts. So what are the facts? Fact number one, there was a guy named Jesus. He walked on the earth. He preached. He made some enemies. They got a hold of him. They crucified him. Fact number one. Fact number two, a group of Jesus' disciples, after his crucifixion and death, came to the tomb in which Jesus was buried, a tomb with a big stone on it and Roman guards guarding it. And they said, when we got to the tomb, we found the tomb empty. I'm not saying the tomb is empty. I'm saying the disciples claimed to find the tomb empty. Third, numerous groups of disciples on different occasions said, "We saw the risen Christ. We saw Christ after his death. He came to us. He spoke to us. He showed us his wounds. And we believe we have seen Christ again." That's claim number three. The disciples claim on numerous occasions to have seen the risen Christ. And four, the disciples were so excited by this and so animated that they began a movement of conversion. Even in the face of horrible persecution and opposition, people said to them, "Renounce Jesus or be killed." Many of them went to their deaths. So now these are the four facts that need to be explained. How are they explained? The Jews, for the first couple of centuries after the death of Christ, said the disciples stole the body. That's why all this happened. The disciples stole the body and then claimed that Jesus was resurrected. But think about it. Disciples, mainly women, somehow fought off the Roman guards, rolled back the stones, stole the body? It's a little far-fetched. How would they have done that? And if they stole the body, they would have known Jesus was actually dead. And yet, why would they go to their deaths in the face of persecution and say, "No, he's alive"? Who would give their life for a lie, for what they know to be a lie? So modern theorists reject that. They don't say they dismiss this idea that the disciples stole the body. They say that's crazy. But the main atheist explanation today is the disciples were having hallucinations. They didn't really see Christ. They weren't lying, because no one goes to their death for a lie. But they it was sort of like you think you saw Elvis, or you think you saw UFOs. But the problem with these hallucinations, for the most part, is that hallucinations are typically private. It's like a dream. Typically, hallucinations aren't shared. You don't have hundreds of people who have exactly the same hallucination. Frankly, if a bunch of people say, "Oh, we were in Vegas, we saw Elvis," are they lying? Are they having a hallucination? No, they probably saw one of the Elvis impersonators that's playing one of the casinos in Vegas. Or people who say, "I saw a UFO," it's not that you're lying, you're not having a hallucination. You probably saw a meteor or a comet. It probably wasn't aliens, but you didn't make it up. These disciples knew Christ. They claimed to have seen him, and they were willing to go to their deaths for what they saw. What's the best explanation for that? Now imagine if the resurrection occurred, that's a fantastic explanation. That would explain why the tomb is empty. That would explain how Jesus came and appeared to them. He really did. And it would explain why in the face of persecution they were able to do what they did. So here's the bottom line. The bottom line is that even when we set aside faith and look at history, there is evidence for God. There is evidence for Christianity. Thank you very much.
Dan, you have 5 minutes for the rebuttal.
Thank you, Dinesh. The first two arguments that Dinesh gave are not evidence. Did you see what he's doing? He's making a flip here. What he gave us was a gap, a problem that we have, a certain unknowable thing that how could it have been? And then he plugs the gap with his God, whatever his God is like. This is known as the God of the gaps. Even though in your book you say you decry that argument, and yet you use that very thing yourself. The ancients used to hear the thunder and see the lightning, and they wondered, what is it? It's a being, an animal, a person, a god up there named Zeus or Thor. And they thought that's what was causing. They didn't know what it was. Now we understand electricity and weather. That gap is closed, and that's what drives science. What day of the week is it today? Thor's day. We have a day of the week devoted to the belief in this God who no longer exists. That gap has closed. It's gone, right? And sure, there are gaps in our current understanding, but that's what drives science. It's wonderful to find these questions, but to just irresponsibly plug it with your God. No cosmologists, and you're way behind the times here, Dinesh. No cosmologist says, first there was nothing. None of them say that. There was no singularity. The Big Bang is the origin of our current universe that we live in. You say that space-time had a beginning, but that's not what cosmologists are saying anymore. That's passé. That's ancient history in cosmology. Even Lee Smolin has come up with a number of his multiverse ideas that even universes themselves go through an evolutionary sort of natural selection. It's a hypothesis. It's a gap, I admit. But scientists say, let's keep the gap open rather than just because of our religious faith, plug it with our ideas. And you're misconstruing what Hawking meant by imaginary time. He's using the word imaginary time in the same way that mathematicians use the phrase imaginary numbers. They're very useful. Hawking was not saying that there's an imaginary time outside of time. What he's saying is that we could conceive of time in two dimensions. Since our brains don't intuitively understand what it could be like to have more than one dimension of time, he says, let's call that imaginary time. And he actually worked out a mathematical model within our universe, not outside of our universe in the brief history of time. So that cosmology that you are presenting to us really is not representing. You're attacking a straw man. Scientists are not saying that thing. The fine-tuning argument, that's a good argument, by the way. But again, it's a god of the gaps. How did all these knobs get turned exactly? Suppose you were in prison and you're going to be executed. Suppose someone tells you, Dinesh, we're going to tie you to a stake and blindfold you, and there are 100 expert riflemen who are going to, at the same time, pull the trigger. They have never missed. You hear the count. Ready, aim, fire, and you hear this loud explosion. But you're still alive. How did that happen? Did they all just miss? What are the odds that you're still alive? What are the infinitesimal odds that maybe that was a conspiracy. Maybe they really liked you and they missed on purpose. Or maybe their guns all jammed. What? That calls for an explanation. The fine-tuning of the constants of our universe do call for an explanation. Why? Why are we here? Why is life here when it seems like it shouldn't be? Then you take off your blindfold and you realize that there were 101 prisoners. Ah, one of them had to survive. According to many of the multiverse theories, our current Big Bang that we live within right now is just one. In fact, there's a Planck constant which limits, it makes the singularity impossible. Quantum fluctuations, in fact, show that nothing comes from nothing. In fact, in outer space right now, complete empty void of outer space, no matter at all, there's quantum uncertainty and wave uncertainty there, and matter and antimatter is constantly being churned and destroyed. Occasionally, like Hawking says, at the horizon of a black hole, one of those escapes, and actually matter is created from nothing at all, from what they call wave probabilities of quantum mechanics. I wrote a whole chapter in my book, which you have, on the resurrection of Jesus. And the arguments you gave are not good historical arguments. We don't know that there were 500 people who saw Jesus. Paul told us in 1 Corinthians that there were 500 people, but he told it to people 25 years later, 1,500 miles away. There was no way anybody was going to verify or confirm these reports. The reports of the resurrection are internally contradictory. There are many other plausible explanations for the origin of the myth. I wish we had time to do a debate on the resurrection of Jesus, but in history, Jesus did not rise from the dead. That is a story. That is an anecdote. That is a religiously motivated idea. Historians say that the Bible is not a reliable source for truth. Therefore, the resurrection is not evidence for a God.
It was Winston Churchill who was asked after the Boer War how he felt, and he said, it's always exhilarating to be shot at without result. When you have a guy who's firing away at your arguments and sort of missing at Dan's rate, I have to feel pretty good. I don't feel like I'm missing any fingers or toes. Stephen Hawking. Just say a word about him. Just to give you an idea of the, in a sense, nonsensical arguments to which atheists are reduced. And what's an imaginary number? Dan spoke of an imaginary number. An imaginary number is something like the square root of -2. Now, theoretically, it's a concept. I agree. You can do mathematics with the square root of -2. But if somebody were to ask you, do you have the square root of -$2 in your pocket? You would say, no, that's ridiculous. It's a concept, but it has no equivalent in actually existing reality. Stephen Hawking admits that. Dan Barker evidently doesn't. Then, the god of the gaps. Basically, here's what's going on here. There are unexplained features in the universe. I'm saying the best explanation is God. Dan's saying he has no idea what the explanation is, but he's assuming it's not God. And he thinks that's an argument. In other words, here we have a universe. It got here. It must have gotten here somehow. It's fine-tuned for life. Someone or something, it got fine-tuned in some way. Dan has no idea how it happened. Now, if we were going and looking on another planet, looking for life, and let's say we were to find buildings, columns, books, artifacts, what would we conclude? We'd say, well, right away, the evidence points to intelligent life on this planet. Somebody did this. It didn't happen by chance. Molecules didn't just fly together and produce these buildings. Someone did it. We may not know who did it, but someone did it. That's a reasonable explanation. Along comes Dan and goes, well, since we don't know who did it, it's a gap. And we can't really say that someone did it. We just don't know. You can't resort to the good old aliens of the gaps. But we would say, of course we can. We have signs of intelligence, and all we are doing is legitimately inferring that some intelligent being did this. We call that being God. That's all that the argument calls for. It's the best explanation available to us now. Maybe Dan will have some new facts in 20 years and come back and present them. But as of now, he has none. What's interesting about this business of gaps, I should tell you, is that for the atheist, a gap is a nuisance. The atheist goes, well, you know, there's this little gap. We scientists haven't figured it out yet. Tomorrow we'll have an answer, or next week, or next year. This is a very unscientific way to argue. Why? Because true scientists love gaps. For a true scientist, a gap is a clue that there may be some defect in our inherent understanding of reality. You know, when we had the Newtonian universe 200 years ago, it explained very well the motions of the planets. But there was one planet, Mercury, whose orbit was slightly off. Newton couldn't predict it. It was a few degrees of angle off, a gap. Now, a lot of scientists with Dan's mentality said, no big deal. It's just a little gap. Maybe there's some matter we haven't found or something. But Einstein recognized, wait a minute. Newton's theory, this gap means that Newton's theory is in a way wrong. And when Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, he went back and remeasured the orbital precession of Mercury, and he found, wow, my theory explains it, the gap is closed. It doesn't mean that there was just a little bit of manure to put into the hole. Newton's entire conception of space and time was in fact inadequate. You needed a deeper understanding of reality to explain the orbital motions of Mercury. So my point is that what atheism is doing now is, you can say, a form of science worship. And if there are things that can't be explained, the atheist has a lot of confidence the brilliant scientists will figure it out tomorrow, whereas in reality, the really brilliant scientists are trying to use the gap to come up with a deeper comprehension of reality. So my point is that this God of the gaps argument is a very unscientific mode of thinking, no less unscientific than the argument it tries to dispute. I'll say a word about the resurrection. You notice that Dan was rebutting arguments that I never made. He said, well, we don't know that there were 500 witnesses. I never mentioned 500 witnesses. I simply said that groups of disciples on multiple occasions claim to have seen the risen Christ. That's a fact. They claim to have seen the risen Christ. There might be a better explanation. They were dreaming. They were hallucinating. They were lying. But you can't just say that they didn't claim to do it. If you do that, you're writing off all of ancient history. I mean, you could say, well, how do we know that Socrates existed? After all, it was only Plato and Xenophon and Aristophanes who mention him. The documents referring to Socrates often came after his death, so we're not going to believe a word of it. My point is, Dan is a music pastor. He's not a historian. If you apply the standards of history using his method, all of ancient history would have to be written off. We would not believe anything we read. We wouldn't believe that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. We wouldn't believe that Alexander the Great conquered Egypt. We wouldn't believe that Socrates walked the streets of Athens. Essentially, ancient history would be reduced to complete nonsense. Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to take about 10 minutes where you guys get to ask each other questions. Obviously, you know, you don't want to take the entire 10 minutes to answer it, so we get a couple questions back and forth. But Dinesh, why don't you go ahead and ask Dan, from either some of the statements you made or from something else you'd like to introduce, a question.
Oh, Dan, maybe perhaps we'll do this, but I ask you a question, you answer, you ask me a question. Is that okay as a format?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. You mentioned that scientists are able to explain the peculiar features of our universe by positing multiple universes. Can you state one piece of empirical evidence that there is even one universe other than our own?
Well, we know it's greater than zero, and we know it's at least one, by what principle would that number be limited to only one? We do know that that minimal Planck distance, which is very tiny, that prohibits the universe from becoming a singularity, we do know that that means that that was not the beginning. There was a time before that Planck time. We do know that. We do also know that space and time itself did not come into existence at that point because there was no singularity. Therefore, cosmologists are not saying, yes, there was a multiverse. What they're saying is the hypothesis of a multiverse, and by the way, there are four different kinds of potential multiverses, the hypothesis of it, just like the 101 prisoners who were getting shot at, right, explains a lot. If in fact the cosmos, now cosmologists are using the word cosmos rather than universe. They use the word universe more in the local sense of our own Big Bang. That our own Big Bang is just one of many billions or trillions of bubbles in a champagne glass, let's say, and there are different formulations of that, and that most of them are stillborn. Most of them are obviously not going to have any constants, but it would be a true miracle if some of them did not have the constants tuned right. It would be a true miracle if one of those 101 prisoners did not survive the 100 bullets.
So, Dan, I asked you if there's any empirical evidence for another universe. I take it your answer is no, because you come back with 101 prisoners, and you say, we do know, but then you state things. Do you know what came before the Big Bang?
Well, then let me ask you.
No, answer my question. You don't know. No one knows.
Yes, but we do know that there was a before. We do know that that Planck minimum was in a quantum state of uncertainty existing already in some state. And it is perfectly sensible to think that if that happened and where did that come from, that it was a part of an infinite series perhaps or whatever. But in the same sense, I would ask you, did Thor exist? That was a big gap in their understanding. Do you think Thor actually existed?
No.
Well, then that gap is closing. But at the time that they came up with Thor, that made sense to them, didn't it? They plugged that gap with their idea. Are you now telling us that science has come to an end? We will never have any more answers to these questions in spite of the history of the success of science in closing these gaps repeatedly?
No, but I'm of course not. Look, Aristotle thought that our mental work was not done in the brain but in the heart. So he was wrong about that. There have been a lot of mistakes in the past. Science does develop. I'm not objecting to the progress of science. I'm objecting to you using what can be called the atheism of the gaps. Which is to say, when you come across something that's unexplained, you assume ultimately an atheist explanation for it. You said we do know what came before the Big Bang. And I think that statement in a way shows how wrong you are about this whole thing, because before the Big Bang, there was no before. If space and time are properties of our universe, the term before only applies to our universe. There was no before, Dan.
Exactly, except our universe that we live in is only one of potentially many. So when you talk about the universe, we're using, in the last 30 or 40 years, philosophers and scientists have changed their usage of the word universe. They now use cosmos for the entire realm of existence. The one universe that you're talking about, the one we happen to inhabit from the Big Bang that we came from, actually goes back to a point that was not a singularity. It goes back to a point where there was already quantum potential sitting there. Just as you know that matter comes out of empty space, the beginning of our universe, we don't know what was before, but we do know that it is perfectly consistent to assume that that state had a pre-existing, it was not the beginning of space and time in the cosmos, it was the beginning of space and time in our local universe. So you're confusing universe and cosmos. The cosmos is indeed eternal.
Well, you began by saying it is one universe of many. You stated as a fact. Now, here in your book, Godless, you say that you're a man of reason. You say that you don't adopt positions in the absence of evidence.
I say that I try.
You try. Well, you're failing right now because at the end of your own statement, you said the words, it is consistent to assume. Consistent to assume means we don't know, but we're just guessing, and it may work out this way, but you started out saying you do know. So here's my point.
I didn't say
my point is, you're accusing me of having positions based on faith and not adopting evidence. I've tried to stay within the parameters of evidence. I haven't appealed to scripture or revelation. I've relied on history and philosophy and science, and I think what I'm showing is that you're playing fast and loose with the facts here.
I am saying that we don't know.
We don't
you
know.
Are
Thank
saying,
you.
You are saying that we do No.
I'm saying that it is a reasonable explanation given fine-tuning to posit a fine-tuner. I asked you if you have a better explanation, so what is it?
Well, it's a reasonable explanation to assume that a quantum state at that level had a pre-existing existence, that space and time did not come into existence at that. That's equally reasonable to assume. If you want to round it off to make a factual claim that there is a God, then why should I not also round it off? I'm not doing that. I'm saying that science works with these probabilities and these hypotheses, and some of them will be wrong.
All right,
Thor,
but then.
Thor was wrong, and we discarded it. And the God of the Bible is wrong, in my opinion, and we will discard it. It's useless. It doesn't really explain, because this immense complexity of the brain of this being out there who created this complexity, where did that come from? Did that, you know, if complexity requires a designer, if functional complexity needs to be designed, how do you account for the functional complexity of the mind of this designer that you are positing? You've dug a huge
hole
here.
All right, well, let me answer in two ways. First of all, one of the problems with the quantum is that when you go to the very microscopic level, matter behaves weirdly. And this is called quantum weirdness. And today people use it to explain virtually everything. So we have two theories. In a sense, we have the idea of a creator, or we have the quantum fluctuation. I mean, now imagine if we were just debating here, for example, whether O.J. did it. We're discussing whether O.J. did it. And I say, look, there's blood evidence, there's handwriting evidence, there's motive. And I put all these things together. I say, therefore, it looks like this was planned and executed. Someone carried it out. And then you say, well, actually, I think it was the result of a quantum fluctuation. How plausible would that be when you've given us no idea how such an explanation would work? You're simply pointing ultimately to a theory in science and saying that did it, when there are not even most scientists who would even agree with you. But let me answer your question. Basically, what Dan is saying is, okay, maybe God did the universe. Maybe some complex mind created the world. But who created that complex mind? That's really his question, and I'm going to answer it. I think that that question is irrelevant to our investigation. And I come back to an analogy I gave a little earlier about us searching for life on other planets. And let's say we are on the planet on Saturn or Jupiter, and we discover that there are all kinds of artifacts and monuments and books and so on. So we say, we conclude that there are intelligent beings on this planet. They must have done this. Now along comes Dan and goes, well, that's a ridiculous explanation. Who created those intelligent beings? And the answer is, who cares? I don't know who created the intelligent being. I'm simply trying to prove that the existence of intelligent artifacts and intelligent life shows that there must be intelligent beings who did this. Who caused them is a matter for a separate investigation. So the fact that we don't know who created the aliens doesn't mean that the aliens didn't do that. And that's the point I'm trying to make here. The fine-tuning of the universe suggests a fine-tuner. We may be able to say very little about who that fine-tuner is or whether someone else created him. Let's leave that aside. At this point, I'm simply saying the universe was fine-tuned. A fine-tuner did it. I'm calling that fine-tuner God. That is a tight argument within its own ambit. And Dan, you've done nothing to challenge that.
Well, let me tear it apart here. You're basically begging the question logically. Because think about what you're doing. Your argument says that the reason there is a God is because we need to explain this complexity. We need to explain the fine-tuning, right? Your premise is, with or without a God, your premise is we have complexity, we have fine-tuning, we have this explanation, and therefore, it must have been created by further complexity, right? And then, within that statement, you're saying, except, let's exclude God. Because you're bringing God into your premise. It's called begging the question. You're saying everything in the universe except God needs an explanation. Everything in the universe, all complexity in the universe except God needs an explanation. You are accepting God. You are bringing him circular reasoning, and that's bad argument. That's bad logic. What a true logician would say is we need to back off from that premise and not have an answer and wait for an answer rather than plug it with your God of the gaps.
Well, I mean, we're waiting, and as new information becomes available, we'll take it into account. But here's my point. My point is that the inference to the best explanation is based on what we do know. So, for example, if I'm walking down a street and I look down an alley and I see a head rolling in the alley, right? I know it didn't just get there automatically. Somebody committed suicide and chopped off their own head, or someone did it. We require some explanation. right? So here we have a universe, and we know it requires explanation. I'm positing an explanation that would account for the intelligent design of the universe. Now, you're saying, how do we account for that being that did that? But see, we know about the universe, we know nothing about that being. If we know, for example, that aliens produced monuments on Jupiter, we still can say nothing about aliens. We have no idea. Do they have 10 eyes? Do they communicate telepathically? We have no idea what those aliens would be like. So therefore, it does not beg the question to say intelligent life did this, but we are unable to account for that intelligent life itself. That's not a begging of the question. That is outside the orbit of our experience, and we know nothing about it. We are now accounting for something that is within our experience, and we're reasonably entitled to infer to an explanation.
Dinesh went over 26 seconds on his rebuttal. Could I take just 10 seconds here? You are positing the explanation of complexity by more complexity. How do we explain complexity? Well, we explain it with more complexity. That's what you're saying. You're explaining one mystery with another mystery, and so you haven't answered your question. You're simply assuming the very thing you're trying to explain.
Very good. Now we'll hear from the audience because they have some questions. Some of them obviously stay within what you've already presented. Some of them, because you've presented something, obviously somebody's thought, wow, they need to explain that. And it goes beyond a little bit sometimes of the purview of what the debate's about. But Dinesh, we're going to start with a question for you. And somebody was very interested in really something that, that Dan brought up. They said, how do you reconcile a belief in evolution, interspecies evolution, with the creation account in Genesis?
The question is about evolution and Genesis. And in a way, when Dan stated my view of this, he ran a little bit roughshod over it. There's an important distinction we have to make here, a distinction between evolution as a scientific notion, a scientific idea, a scientific theory, and what can be called metaphysical Darwinism. Now, Darwin was actually both. He was a scientist, and he also, toward the end of his life, became an atheist. He never called himself an atheist. He said agnostic. But he was essentially he became very anti-Christian. Why did Darwin become anti-Christian? It had nothing to do with evolution. Darwin became very angry at God because one of his children, his young daughter Annie, at the age of 10, became sick and died. And Darwin said, from that point, I decided, almost as a form of revenge against God, to reject the Christian God. Now, evolution is an explanation. It's not an explanation of life. Many people think evolution explains how life got started. Wrong. Evolution assumes life. Evolution assumes self-replicating cells. A self-replicating cell has all the built-in complexity of a computer. Darwin didn't even try to account for that. He said, I'm assuming that. I'm going to try to show you how we go from life form A to life form B. Now, when Darwin published his Origin of Species, a Harvard biologist, Asa Gray, who's a devout Christian, wrote to Darwin and said, you know, ever since I've been reading, in all the years I've been reading the Bible, it tells me that God made the universe and God made life, but the Bible doesn't say how. Your theory of evolution offers a very good explanation of how this may have all come to pass. And Darwin was thrilled. He actually took Asa Gray's letter and would publish it in subsequent editions of The Origin of Species. So here's the bottom line. Evolution by itself is not a threat to Christianity or to Genesis. However, Darwinian metaphysical Darwinism, the idea that this is all an unguided process that doesn't need a creator, that somehow evolution will magically one day account for the origin of life, this is all metaphysical Darwinism. It's essentially atheism that has been injected into evolution. I completely reject that.
Can I respond to that?
If you'd like to, for a minute.
You write in your book, it seems improbable that the small group of intelligent design advocates is right and the entire community of biologists is wrong. You write in here with admiration of that group of Jews who consider the story of Adam and Eve to be a parable and a metaphor, that Adam and Eve actually did not exist as historical people. I applaud you for that. That's good liberal thinking. That's good. Adam and Eve did not exist. Otherwise, who were the first human beings? It was like when Jesus told the parable of the prodigal son, that wasn't really a person, and Adam and Eve were not really people either, and that's, I think, how you and I both see the Genesis story as an attempt by primitive people to try to make a fable. And by the way, look up the word fable in the dictionary. It's a moral tale that involves a talking animal. They invented this fable to try to give some meaning, but Adam and Eve did not exist historically. I think you agree with me.
Well, let me answer that. Because the word Adam means the original man. So in that sense, you can say, was his name Adam? We're calling him Adam. He was the original man. And what do we mean by the original man? By the original man, we mean biblical man, moral man, man who's capable of reasoning. Now, here's a question that we don't know. Were there any other beings on the planet before Adam and Eve, or while Adam and Eve were alive? The Bible leaves this question open. Why? Because Adam and Eve had two children, Cain and Abel. Cain killed Abel and then moved to another country. Was he alone? He obviously married and had children. Whom did he marry? Eve? His mom? So the point is, the Bible leaves open the question of whether or not there might have been other creatures on earth, even though Adam and Eve, in a sense, were the first. In a sense, they are the first man and woman to be biblical, which is to say, to be able to reason between good and evil. So this is not a rejection of the literal account of Genesis. It's an attempt to try to interpret it in an intelligent way. Here's the thing we should remember as Christians. The Bible is inerrant, meaning free of mistakes, but we're not. Our interpretations of the Bible are not infallible. And therefore, we are trying as intelligent Christians to make sense of things and to understand them better. What Dan is doing really here is trying to exploit thoughtful ambiguity and make it seem like a rejection of Scripture. It's not. It's an affirmation of Scripture. It's loving God not just with our heart, but with our mind. And that's what Christians should do.
Very good. Dan, one of the best questions we actually got was from an eighth grader here at PCA, but Dinesh already asked you about that one, so I'm going to go on to this one. It says, you say that the cosmos is eternal, which would mean that it is infinite, yet it has been proven mathematically that an infinite is impossible. What do you say to Hilbert's Hotel?
Well, if that's true, if an actual infinity does not exist in reality, then God, who is supposedly actually infinite, cannot exist in reality, right? If it's sauce for the goose, it's sauce for the gander. If you cannot have an actual infinity, and when you think about it, it does kind of make sense, because what was God's first thought? You know, didn't he have a sort of temporal antecedence to his thoughts all back through infinity? There are different kinds of infinities, and there are infinities that you would call not linear infinities, like a chain of events that goes back forever, but there are also what you would call bounded infinities, which our current universe is a bounded infinity. If you were to go in a straight line, straight up from here, just straight, not varying at all, what would happen? According to Einstein, do you know what would happen? You'd come back up through your feet. It's a bounded four-dimensional infinity. So yes, the cosmos can be conceived of as infinitely existing in time itself, and Hawking, to his credit, is trying to explain how time could not be a straight line. He conceives of it as two-dimensional time, imaginary time, not that it actually is a thing that exists, but if time does go sideways, just like a dimension of a big beach ball, you can go in any direction and come up to whatever point, you can have a cosmos that is a bounded infinity, and perhaps if there's a God, then his infinity is also a bounded infinity.
If I can answer briefly, there's no question that there can be immaterial infinities. I'll give you one right now. The sequence of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Keep counting, and you can go on forever. There's no place you have to stop. If you're talking about something immaterial, like numerical values, we know that can be an infinity. So if God is immaterial, as the Christian God is taken to be immaterial, not having a body, there's absolutely no intellectual or conceptual problem with an immaterial being being infinite. The problem is we don't know of any material infinities. If somebody says, here's a seashore and it stretches for miles and the number of grains of sand on it is infinite, the answer is, sorry pal, it's a lot, but it's probably not infinite. So the question was a very good one. Are there material infinities? And the answer is, we're not sure, probably not, but it's no problem with the idea of God being infinite.
All right, here's a question that I'm going to assume that neither of you have ever gotten, so we'll try it out. It actually goes for both of you. So Dinesh, what is the best evidence or argument for atheism? And then Dan, I guess the opposing question would be, what is the best argument or evidence for theism or Christianity? So kind of put you in each other's shoes for a minute.
The best argument for atheism, in my view, is one that Dan alluded to but did not develop, which is the prevalence of suffering and evil in the world. And the best argument for atheism is that God is powerful, God is good. So why then do we have as much suffering as we do? Why does a 5-year-old kid get cancer? Doesn't God have the power to stop him? If he does, why doesn't he? Now, I do want to point out, by the way, Dan cited this as an example of how he became an atheist. To me, this is not an argument about God's existence. And here's why. Imagine if I trusted my dad, and I thought him to be a great guy, very powerful, has all kinds of influence, a really good guy, loves me very much. And then I'm in a desperate situation, I really need help, I turn to my dad, "Dad, help me," and he won't do it. For whatever reason, he won't do it. Do I conclude, well, therefore my dad does not exist? This would be idiotic. Obviously my dad exists. I may change my opinion of my dad. I may go, why doesn't he help me? What's wrong with him? In other words, my point is I may have doubts about the character of my dad, but not about his existence. So to me, the problem of suffering is fallaciously advanced as an argument against the existence of God, but for a lot of people lose their faith or reject their faith because they claim to object to the character of God.
I think you're right. The problem of evil is not an argument against any particular God existing. It's an argument against the existence of a good God. The Christian God is defined as a good God, benevolent God. Therefore, the problem of evil is a real thorn to those who think God is a good God. There might be an indifferent God, or there might be a cruel God, in which case that argument disappears. There are no really, really good arguments for theism or for Christianity, but if I had to pick the best for Christianity, it would be history. I would give the historical evidence for Jesus about maybe 10 or 20% probability. It's there. We have a book. We have a Bible. We have documents. We can read them. And by the way, Dinesh is wrong when he claims that the hallucination theory is the main theory among the critics of the resurrection. It is not the main theory. I know Robert Price talks about that as one potential. The main hypothesis is not the hallucination theory, but the legend theory. And I write about that in great detail in my book, Legend/Myth. And it could be both. Jesus may not have even existed, but even if he did exist, the New Testament story shows footprints of legendary embellishment. It was cut from the same fabric as other ancient mythologies. Even the second century Christian apologist, Justin Martyr, when he was arguing with the pagans, he said, "Why do you pagans resist Christianity? You have virgin births, you have ascensions into heaven, you have all these miracles and healings, and so there's nothing different." Justin Martyr told the pagans, there's nothing different in between paganism and Christianity. Christianity was cut from that fabric. So, but we do have documents, and we should look at those documents and analyze them, as you say, intelligently. We should look at them with our minds and see what they say. And when you do look closely at the historical evidence for Christianity, you have to give it some credibility, but all history is a matter of probabilities. In fact, all science is probabilities. History, being the weakest of the legitimate sciences, gives us the least amount of confidence, even that Socrates existed, for example. We don't know 100% for sure, but when it comes to historical confidence for the New Testament, maybe it goes to 10 or 20%. But the trouble is that people like you take that low probability and round it off to factuality, when in fact there are many other explanations, which I do go into in greater detail in a section of my book, that show that the story can be explained in purely naturalistic terms.
May I briefly? I mean, it seems to me, Dan, that just doesn't make sense of the facts. Look, I might say I'll make up a legend and go tell my friends, because that'll make me powerful, they'll listen to me, and so on. But then when a Roman soldier grabs me and sticks me into the Colosseum and puts in a friendly lion and says, "Dinesh, will you admit it, you made this stuff up," I'm going to say, "Yeah, it was pretty good while it lasted. I made it up, I admit it." I'm not going to go to my death, as many of the early Christians did, for something that I knew to be a lie.
But all religions have their martyrs. Buddhists set themselves on fire. Muslims are martyrs.
But that's a fallacy, because they're setting themselves on fire in anticipation of a future event that may or may not come to pass. The 9/11 terrorists might have expected the 72 virgins, and now they're being attended by some hairy guys with tattoos. They were wrong. They're guessing about the future.
But in any event, they did not back off from their fervently held beliefs. It happens in all religions, and if you believe something, there are parents right now today, there are Christian mothers and fathers who allow their children to die as a test of their faith. There was a couple in Wisconsin that were just convicted. The little girl died of easily treatable diabetes on Easter Sunday, screaming, and yet they would not take her to the doctor because the Bible says the prayer of faith will heal the sick. That girl is dead, and those parents are unrepentant because their faith led them to murder their own daughter. And many people, when they get attracted to a faith, if the Jesus story did happen, it's no big surprise. Look at how Mormons became martyrs for their faith, and yet you don't believe the angel Moroni and the hill Cumorah and the little magic stones and all that stuff. People latch onto a religious system, and some of them, at this end of the bell curve of mental health, some of them become martyrs for any faith in the world.
Right, but you're confusing what happens once a faith is developed within the faith from the origin of faith. In other words, think about it. The early Christians had to convince a substantial portion of the Roman Empire had already converted to Christianity before Constantine. These were very, in other words, Christianity had spread widely prior to the Roman emperor converting, and then eventually it had to be promoted worldwide. So here's my point. My point is it defies historical explanation to take an event that is an historical event. There was an early church. There were early Christians. They did face persecution. Try to explain those facts without saying that something happened. To say that there wasn't even a Jesus, that someone just made him up, defies explanation.
Something did happen, and there may have been a Jesus. There were many self-proclaimed messiahs in the first century BC. There was a Judas the Christ, a Theodas the Christ. There was this Apollonius guy. There was an Egyptian Jew messiah. There may have been a Yeshua the Christ, a Jew who has started this movement, who died. But that might have happened, but the legendary development afterwards, the New Testament itself is a big cartoon story based maybe on a real person. Skeptics aren't in agreement about whether it was total myth or just part myth and part legend. So yes, you can have people dying for a belief in something that he was seen, that he's, you know, Elvis was seen, you know, or that Jesus was seen from the dead. People would believe that and they would give their lives for it. It happens.
I haven't seen anyone dying for Elvis.
People swooned for Elvis, but
but that was a real Elvis. Go ahead.
Speaking of death. And Dan, this is primarily to you, but Dinesh has just written a book about it, so I'm sure he'll respond to it. But if you believe only in the material and not the supernatural, what do you believe happens when you die?
Death is death. What do you mean? What happens when you die? When you die, you die. The organism decays, you fall apart, and you're not here anymore. Before I was born, there was a huge amount of time, perhaps an eternity, during which I did not exist. Didn't bother me one bit. After I'm dead, the same will be true. That's what death means. There is no evidence. Even Einstein said it's inconceivable that there's any evidence that somehow this spirit, whatever that is, and maybe Dinesh can define what a spirit is, an immaterial being. What in the world is an immaterial being? There's no evidence that there's any survival of our consciousness and our personality. When you turn off the computer, the software is gone. When this brain dies and decays, look what happens with Alzheimer's. Look what happens with our body when it falls apart. Death is death. The important thing to us atheists who know that we're going to die, it makes life more precious. If life is eternal, then life is cheap. We put more value on things that are rare and precious, right? So that we know that this might be my last moment, and I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to live it. I'm going to exult in the beauty of all of this and some of the ugliness as well. So when you die, you die. You're dead. And, you know, sure, we'd like to extend our life, but even Woody Allen said if there's an eternal life, when does it end, you know? He also said, I don't believe in life after death, but just in case I'm taking a change of underwear. That whole idea that we want to live on is sort of a selfish thing. We'd live on in the memories of those who remain, and we live on in the lingering deeds of the actions we have done on this earth. That's how we live on. We do not live on in any immaterial soul spiritual way. That is just a myth. That is a lie. That is wishful thinking. And if you're basing your life on that, you're wasting precious time of the real life that we have as biological animals in this natural environment.
Truth of it is, if you set aside Jesus Christ, no one knows what comes after death. So it's very interesting that you here have Dan, a champion of reason, who has to admit that he has no idea what comes after death, just as the caterpillar has no idea it's going to become a butterfly. And yet Dan states as a factual matter, it's a myth, it's a lie. Why would somebody be so passionate about something that they have absolutely no information about? I would suggest that Dan is taking a faith-based rejection of life after death. In other words, Dan doesn't want there to be a life after death. Why? And we forget this. He keeps telling us believers want to live forever. Atheists don't want to live forever. Why? Because nobody wants to be judged for their actions. If there is a death, there may well be a last judgment. Or even in other religions, there's cosmic justice. So there's, in a way, for many people, a desire to avoid moral accountability. And therefore, they will profess as fact something that they do not know to be a fact. In reality, there's actually some powerful indications that there is life after death. I go into these in a recent book of mine. I'm not going to belabor the arguments now. The little empirical evidence we do have, and that is these near-death experiences, people who are not dead, but very close to death. They have cardiac arrest, their brain has stopped showing any signs of activity, and yet they report experience. They're conscious, they say they are pulled through a tunnel, they see a bright light, they feel their life come before them, they encounter deceased relatives and friends, they are in the presence of a celestial being. There are thousands of these near-death experiences reported all over the world. They're taking place right now. And if they are true, if all these people aren't conspiring and all lying, and frankly, no one thinks they are, the truth of it is that shows that consciousness and experience can survive the breakdown of your bodily functions. That's empirical evidence. The atheists have no evidence. They don't want there to be life after death, so it's only wishful thinking on their part that there should be no last judgment and no life after death. At the very least, I wish they'd just step back and say they don't have a clue.
I would like there to be life after death. I never said that. I think it would be fascinating if that were true, to extend our lives. I think.
So why do you say it's a lie when you have no idea one way or the other?
Because what does death mean, right? You mean the death of the body. Your evidence is not evidence for life after death. It's a near-death experience. You haven't crossed any line with these near-death experiences. They're evidence for something going on in our mind. In fact, do you know that these same chemicals that are released to the brain when people are dying, these opioids and endorphins, have been administered to people who are not dead, and under the experience of these opioids, they had near-death experiences. The brain hallucinates, and when the brain goes, it's fighting to live, and it does hallucinate in all these ways and has these interesting, fast, even atheists will have near-death experiences and not think it's Jesus. A Muslim will see Allah, right? A Christian will see Jesus, and atheists, who knows, we see a blank piece of paper, I suppose, but what you just gave us is not evidence for life after death. It's for evidence for how the brain functions near death. And, you know, if there's a life after, and if there's a judgment, if there's a God, I'm not fighting that. I'm not afraid of moral restrictions. I'm not afraid of being judged. And if I'm going to be judged, fine, I'll own up to my judgment. I don't want somebody else paying the death penalty for my actions. We atheists are responsible and mature about this. And in spite of the fact that I might wish to live forever, I'm going to stick with what we do know. And we do not know at this point, beyond what some holy book tells us, that there's any life after death.
Well, you say that there is a prevailing theory, which I discuss at some length. It's called the dying brain hypothesis. And that is, it tries to explain the near-death experiences by saying that when your brain is dying, it goes into shutdown mode, and it has these experiences of a tunnel, a bright light, but it's just special effects generated by the dying brain. There's one serious problem with this hypothesis that has never been answered. There are tens of thousands of people who have had near-death experiences. Where are they now? Answer, they're walking around. They're going to work. They have families. They drive cars. So if their brains have died, the dying brain in the process of shutting down has generated the near-death experience, how has their brain reversed the entire process, evidently healed itself, so it's now functioning completely normally? It would be sort of like saying, I've turned off the car, I've taken the key out, and the car is still running. So the truth of it is these near-death experiences cannot be so easily dismissed. Dan is trying to dismiss them by saying, look, the only evidence I'll accept is if a dead guy gets out of the coffin, shows up at his funeral, and gives the tribute to himself. True, we don't have that kind of evidence. The near-death experience is the closest people come to death. Many of these people are clinically dead. they should not be having experience, and yet they do. So what gets me is the atheists are always asking for facts. Give us experience. Don't cite the Bible. Don't give us legends. Give us actual empirical evidence. Here I put 10,000 cases on the table, and Dan goes, well, haven't convinced me yet. What's he waiting for?
We're going to finish up with final closing arguments, and Dan, you're going to go ahead and go first. You have 5 minutes.
Thanks. In the New Testament, Jesus gave a lot of advice. Some of it was good. Most of it was not. Most of the moral advice that Jesus gave, such as showing how compassionate he was by advising that some of your slaves should not be beat as hard as others, and never denouncing slavery, saying things that such as marrying a divorced woman is adultery. Are there any people here who have married a divorced woman? According to Jesus, you're committing adultery. Talking about cutting off body parts and gouging out eyes, preaching hell almost with glee, weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, giving useless, counterproductive advice such as don't plan for the future, take no thought for the morrow. If you lose a lawsuit, pay double what you have lost. If any man asks you for anything, give it to them without exception, and so on. But he did say some good things. The golden rule is not bad. Of course, it's not unique to Christianity. Confucius, half a millennium before Christianity, said it in a better way. That which you find harmful to yourself, don't do to others, which is much better than the do unto others formulation that we hear within Christianity. I wouldn't call it a golden rule. I might think it's a bronze rule, perhaps. It was Oscar Wilde, I think, who said, the problem with do unto others is what if you have bad taste? But there's one thing that Jesus said that I do admire. If Jesus existed, and he may have, but I doubt it, if he existed and if he said the things that the writers of the New Testament said that he said, which I doubt, but let's just take it as a literary statement. Jesus said that they who are healthy, they who are whole, don't go to the doctor. Only they who are sick. He was talking, of course, about the Christian system, which is the salvation system. Christians might say, well, we are no different from the rest of the world. We can admit it, but we are saved and they aren't, which is what I used to preach. Yeah, Christians really aren't any better. Christians are not more moral, more kind, more giving. Of course, every group has its saints and its sinners. But those of us who are outside the Christian system and that I used to be within, we don't see ourselves as sick. Salvation is a religious cure to a religious problem. The Bible creates this problem of whatever you want to call it, original sin. As in Adam, all die, so in Christ shall all be made alive. And then it purports to solve this problem that it created. You are all sick. You're all bad. You're going to be judged. You're all deserving of hell. How many children have gone to bed at night fearful that they might die and go to hell? What a horrible doctrine to teach children. It's almost a form of child abuse. How much respect would you have for a doctor who runs around cutting people with a knife in order to sell them a Band-Aid? Well, that's what Christianity is. Christianity's got it all wrong. It's telling you that you're bad. You're horrible. You're just not a good person. Of course, there is a violent tendency within our species, but there's also a naturally evolved, instinctive, altruistic tendency. We are naturally good people. When someone commits a horrible deed, what do you say? That was an inhuman thing to do. We assume that the basic human thing to do is good. We who are outside the Christian system, we don't assume the worst about human nature. In fact, assuming the worst can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You can think, oh, I'm a horrible sinner. I need to confess to Jesus. But we think that since salvation is a phony solution to a phony problem, we think that if salvation is the cure, then atheism is the prevention. Just don't buy into the sickness. Don't view yourself as sick and needing a savior. I did a debate in Queens, New York with a Muslim opponent, and afterwards I told Ali, I told him, you Muslims, you're so kind and good, and they gave me gifts and they fed me food, and it was just a wonderful experience to meet this Muslim community. And I said, Ali, you people are so nice. And he said, well, Don, Allah commands me to be nice to you. And I'm thinking, oh, I didn't say this, but I'm thinking, oh, you mean you're restraining yourself? You really don't want to be nice to me because God's telling you to? You're being nice to me? The The Abrahamic religion system is totally upside down about human nature. We atheists and agnostics don't view anything wrong with us. Of course, our understanding is limited, and that's what drives science. But we think that if you're motivated to be a good person because of the promise of heaven, that shows how little you think of other people, really. Or if you're motivated to be a good person because of the threat of hell, that shows how little you think of yourself. We humanists think that human beings should be good for goodness' sake.
If we are merely evolved primates in the world, our job in life is to survive and to reproduce and to benefit ourselves. Why should we be good for goodness' sake? There is no goodness built into evolution. We are selfish creatures in the world. If we are good, it means that there is a part of our nature. If we are good to strangers with no benefit to ourselves, that says that there is a part of our humanity that cannot be explained in purely evolutionary terms. I don't really want to waste time rebutting Dan's really absurd portrait of Jesus, the idea that he took glee in hell. There's absolutely no passage where Jesus takes glee. Jesus is essentially giving you, in a sense, an emergency package for how to avoid this terrible outcome. And for some reason, the animus against Jesus, I think, itself requires psychological explanation. Because think about it. Wouldn't the world be a better place if everybody followed the teachings of Jesus, if everybody turned the other cheek, was kind and gentle, forgave others for offenses? If you look at Jesus' teachings, never hurt anybody. Even then, it's not enough for Dan. He's able to ransack through the Bible and find Jesus was rude to his mom, things like that. It suggests to me, in a sense, a bitterness that I think is now become part very often, not always, of modern atheism. I want to answer his point about sick people, because I think that the case for Christianity depends upon the acknowledgement of the following fact. Things are not as they ought to be. Anybody in this room disagree? I don't see any hands up. I think we'd all agree that we live on two levels. Here's the way things are. Let's call that the human level. And we all know, we can envision, we hope for a better world. Perfect justice, perfect beauty, perfect truth. Let's call that the divine level. That's the way things ought to be. So there's a huge chasm between the way things are and the way things ought to be. And how do you bridge this chasm? The atheist goes, that's the wrong diagnosis. We're doing great right now. That's just a foolish refusal to acknowledge the depravity and the difficulty that even Darwin admits is built into human nature. We are selfish, grasping, tribal beings in the world. All you have to do is set people loose and remove laws. Just let the cops take a week off and see what happens. That's human nature. Let's be realistic about it. So here's the way we are. Here's the way things ought to be. And most religions in the world say that humans can climb up to the divine level by following a set of codes and commandments. That's Judaism. That's Islam. You follow a diet, follow these rules, and man can step by step move up to God. Christianity is unique and radical in saying, in effect, no. This gap is too big. We're sick in that sense. We cannot climb high enough to get to God's level. We can go up a couple of rungs, but it's ultimately not going to make a difference. Jesus saw that. So Jesus' point, in a sense, is the only way to close the gap is to reverse it. This level has to come down to our level. God has to, in some sense, become man. That's the only way to close this chasm. And Jesus ultimately is, if you will, God's emissary, God's ambassador to the world. And look at what Jesus says. He basically says, yes, we can't jump over the bar. In that sense, we're all guilty. But here's the remedy. What do we have to do to achieve salvation? Only one thing. Admit it. Essentially, if you plead guilty, you are going to get an acquittal. I mean, what could be a gentler, easier counsel than to say, whatever you've done, even Hitler, if you have true repentance, salvation is assured to you. So what is it in human nature that rebels against a message so easy? In a sense, Christ is essentially saying, we're all up on trial, And all we got to say is, I did it, and we can go scot-free. Imagine if our criminal justice system worked that way. Ultimately, Christianity is offering something that remedies a built-in problem in human nature. It's not ultimately just about the Bible. The Bible is a way of interpreting human nature. But I think ultimately what atheism is it's a cop-out. It's a refusal to look human nature in the face. It's a refusal to recognize that there is a better world, that we haven't gotten there yet. And in some senses, there are many questions. Why do we have a universe? Why are we here? Where are we going? Science supplies no answer to those questions. Science is in the dark. So to just look to science is valuable. I need it for my iPod. I need it for a lot of stuff in the world every time I get on a plane. But ultimately, God answers the deeper questions, and Christianity gives us hope. Thank you very much.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for spending a little bit of time with us. I wanted to thank Dan and Dinesh both for coming. I hope they raised some great questions for you. If you're interested in continuing the conversation, we've prepared a discussion guide that you can get. You can order, and we will either email it to you or you can pick it up. And so hopefully that will be something that will help you to continue on in the conversation. Dinesh is going to walk out of here and walk out to Main Street and do a book signing of his new book. And I just want to remind you, especially for those of you who are our guests, that we're going to do this again next year. And we're looking at the possibility of sort of continuing this conversation and doing the evolution versus creation debate again. So hopefully you'll join us again next year. Thanks for coming.
I sure hope you've enjoyed this debate and are encouraged to discuss the claims and the counterclaims that were made today. In fact, all of our students right now are heading to small groups where they're going to talk about some of these claims and the counterclaims. And I want to encourage you to keep the dialogue alive and consider taking it a step further. Again, as I said earlier, you can order or purchase the study guide that helps you in the small group discussion. You can go onto our website and do that. You can also invite others to watch this debate on this site through the video on demand. And talking about keeping the dialogue alive, I want to introduce you to one of our students, Taylor Henry. Taylor's a senior at PCA and serves as our student government president. Taylor, how you doing?
I'm doing good.
I want to welcome you. I'm doing great. You know, we're doing this for students. We're trying to prepare them for the university. And Taylor, in a few months, you're going to be off on a university campus. And I just want to ask you as a student, how, you know, the debate today, how does this prepare you to enter the university? What does it make you think of?
Well, first, I think the important thing to realize is college's life is going to be a lot different than in high school. And so, especially at Christian schools where we get to learn this all through our high school classes, and we're going to reach a totally new environment when we go off to college. And I think discussions like this kind of open us up to how we're supposed to talk to people who don't necessarily believe the same things as us. Because it's not just important to know the right thing, because we can all say that we know the right thing, but everyone knows that guy out there who knows the right thing and that they think he's full of himself just because he can't talk to anyone about it. And I think this is a civil way to kind of understand how we're supposed to talk and debate and have discussion with people who don't share our same interests.
That's great, Taylor. Thank you very much, Taylor. We're excited about the impact you're having on our campus and the impact you'll have wherever God leads you in the future of the university. And there's more to come in the future. I want you to encourage you to mark your calendar for this same time next year when we will be hosting another Biblical Worldview Institute program, probably another debate. And talking about the future, I want to invite the Christian school administrators to the Kingdom School Institute. If you are an administrator that's interested in learning more about bringing worldview instruction into your classrooms and your programs, I want to encourage you to attend our annual conference, the Kingdom School Institute Conference. It's held every year in June. It'll be in June 2010 in Nashville, Tennessee. You can click onto the button next to the viewing screen to learn more about how you can join other school leaders to become part of this important event. I also want to encourage you to check out the Student Leadership Institute program. The SLI is a program that develops students into leaders who lead by example in service to their homes or schools, their churches and the communities. That we have conferences where we train, where you can learn the dynamics of this exciting program that's being embraced by schools across the country. You can click on the SLI button next to the viewing screen to find out more information about our next training conference. Again, thank you for joining us today, and may God bless you.